Some embrace the idea of white privilege as an important concept that helps us to make sense of the connection between race and social and political disadvantages, while others are critical or even hostile. Regardless of personal views, it can be difficult to agree on what white privilege even means. Philosopher Shannon Sullivan cuts through the confusion in Crosstalk to challenge what, quote, everyone knows, unquote, about white privilege. Using real-life examples, she offers a candid assessment of the advantages and disadvantages of the term to present a better understanding of how race functions in our societies. She argues that white privilege is about more than race, that not only white people can have white privilege, and that feeling guilty about privilege can have a negative effect on the very people you feel guilty towards. In the end, she offers practical solutions for eliminating white privilege and building a fairer society. Shannon Sullivan is professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to just start, cut to the chase. What is white privilege? And also, you also hear the term white male privilege. And I'm curious how much that affects things as well.
With the term white male privilege, that like immediately brings up the way that white privilege has to be thought about in connection with things other than race, with class, with gender. I talk about class in particular. I think a lot of times what we call white privilege is really a white class privilege. And using white privilege as a kind of blanket term to describe the kinds of privileges, I'll come back to that term, the kind of advantages that all white people get receive as if those are the same, can be misleading, and it can create resentment and hostility toward the notion to just make it seem like it's something fictitious that's been made up. Because if you're a really poor white person, you know, you're looking around saying, well, where's my privilege? I don't seem to have any. So the term, I think, can be misleading. It has to be thought in connection with class as well as gender. But at the same time, I don't want to throw it out. There's a different kind of danger on the other side of throwing the term out if it seems clunky. That's problematic too, because there is something that it's trying to speak to about advantages that white people get no matter what their class or economic background.
Can you talk about some of those advantages?
Whatever this thing is, white privilege or white class privilege that we're talking about, it operates outside of or apart from the law. There is absolutely nothing illegal about the advantages or privileges that white people get when they get them. And a real quick shorthand of thinking about what white privilege is getting the benefit of the doubt in a situation. Getting pulled over if you're speeding, forgetting your parking ticket when you're exiting the lot and you're supposed to then be penalized some huge sum because you've lost your ticket. These sound like very small examples, and in some ways they are very everyday ways that white people often are given the benefit of the doubt, and it operates outside the law. The issue comes up when there are implicit and unconscious ways in which white people in particular tend to get that benefit of the doubt, tend to get let off the hook, and we can see those patterns that are operating. Again, it's not illegal, but it gives advantages, privileges, little boost up across white people's lives.
What inspired you to write this book?
This book is trying to reach a broader audience and gets outside of just talking to folks within the university about what does this thing white privilege look like in everyday people's lives, and trying to have a kind of frank conversation about that doesn't jump to just guilt or shame and sort of shut the conversation down in that way.
So what does it look like in real life outside of the academic institution?
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of white people, when they give examples, almost always talk about the police officer. And I've already mentioned this. The police officer pulls you over and you get a warning instead of a ticket. For a lot of, and maybe I need to say middle class or upper middle class white people, this is less true if you're a poor white person. But the interactions you have with the police, you don't have very many of them. Another example would be the way flight attendants sometimes treat different people in terms of, are you allowed on the plane with a bag that's slightly larger than it's supposed to be or not? You know, is there a strict measurement or not? Who gets the benefit of doubt there and who doesn't? And again, it sounds like maybe something very small, but if you add up these little bitty stressors that often show up in the lives of people of color, these are very real in terms of saying who counts as a full person in our society. They're very real health effects that go along with dealing with those stressors over and over again. And what we don't talk about, though, are the little boosts and benefits that white people get from having their lives smoothed along, you know, along the way as they get those little boosts, those little benefits of the doubt. I think you also see this in renting housing situations in terms of who gets the benefit of the doubt, who's seen as an upright citizen that you can trust versus who are you worried about that might implicitly be a criminal or a poor choice for someone to rent to or implicitly criminalized, in other words. Whiteness definitely benefits white people many times across class lines, although, again, we've got to talk about differences there, too.
And can we talk about the differences in terms of class?
Yeah, I worry the word white privilege really does make it sound like someone's born with a silver spoon in their mouth, and that's just not true for a lot of white people. And sometimes what we're calling white privilege is more the lack of an obstacle. And it's hard to see the lack of something. If I don't have a particular obstacle in my life, I might be poor, I might have a lot of obstacles, but there might be an obstacle that I don't have that I can't see that people of color have in their lives. And so there still is the advantage, a little bit of a benefit of a doubt that's functioning, but again, sometimes functioning as something that's missing, again, an obstacle that's missing in one's life. That's hard to see, and talking about it as a privilege makes it look like something positive to try and find in one's life rather than sometimes an obstacle that's not there. I sometimes prefer the term white priority. You know, prior means to come before someone, and there's a lot of ways I have argued that whatever someone's financial or economic or class situation as a white person, there is a felt sense of not being at the bottom of the ladder, the bottom rung of society, and that someone else is there, that no matter how poor I am as a white person, I'm prior in the sense of coming before someone else, people of color. And I think that is a very deeply ingrained in the United States in ways that we find very difficult to talk about.
One thing that I like to challenge is the idea that, and I think sometimes this is part of why we get the pushback, and I wonder if this is why we get the pushback from white, if you would say white privileged male, they might say, wait a minute, when you think of people like Jordan Peterson, who talks about, you know, suicide rates being higher mm-hmm. among white men, mm-hmm. How many men have, you know, heart trouble, how many men live shorter lives. So this idea that men just have this inherent advantage, but is it really true, or is it how we're choosing to frame it? And that maybe even the word privilege might be the wrong word to use if we're looking for greater understanding between each other, that is it a term that we often use that actually only sometimes even divides people more?
That's a really good point. My way of thinking about this is not to try and get people to use the term white privilege all the time. It may be sometimes that just as you were saying, interferes with some frank, honest discussions about what's going on. It's a moment to try and ask questions and get some clarity and do it in a way that's not just about guilting or shaming other people, but try and talk honestly about what's going on, but that also doesn't sidestep away from talking about race and talking about whiteness. I mean, most white people don't like to talk about race. It just makes them very uncomfortable. As one scholar, Robin DiAngelo, has called it a kind of fragility, a white fragility that white people have. They find it very difficult emotionally and psychologically to withstand any kind of discussion or possible tension around talking about race. And then heaven forbid, not just race. So if white people are willing to talk about race, it often means talking about, so to speak, those other people, people of color, black people, Latino, Latina, Hispanic people. So what does it mean to sort of shine the light on oneself and acknowledge that one a white person has a race, is not raceless? And how does race function in one's life? That tends to make white people very, very uncomfortable. And so while I don't feel like we need to insist on using the term white privilege, and in some contexts it can be counterproductive, we do need to find some ways to have conversation about race and whiteness and how they're functioning in our society.
How do you suggest that we do that?
a lot of the increased suicide rates for white men have to do with a loss of a sense of priority that they've been used to having in our society, both in terms of their race and their gender, and that to lose that is being felt as a trauma, and there has to be some way to talk about that. Now, I'm saying that in a way that's not morally justifying it or disapproving it, but sort of describing what it means to feel like you lose that priority, and there needing to be some discussion about that. I do think that something is being taken away from them. I think it was an unjust situation that they had it in the first place, a kind of just granted privilege because of gender and race. It was problematic that it was there in the first place. But if it's been there and been an expectation for centuries in the United States, when that gets taken away, you see, I think, a kind of existential struggle for where then do I as a white man fit then in this world if the way I'm used to looking at, I'm now being told that doesn't work anymore. So I think as a society we're struggling with a lot of that, and haven't found some good answers to what does it mean to remake whiteness, and here a masculinized whiteness in particular that isn't built on that sense of priority. I think we white people have got a long way to go, a lot of work for figuring out some of those questions about our identity and our place in the world that doesn't depend on that those kinds of advantages and priorities.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to author and philosopher Shannon Sullivan speaking about her new book, White Privilege, due out in the fall, as well as her current book, Good White People. I mean, what does white even mean? Can you kind of talk a little bit about that as well, the nebulousness of the term even white? It seems to be free of any form of ethnicity, and even in that sense, are we doing it justice for those on the side of white privilege?
It's been a shifting, changing, evolving term. You know, whether even the Germans counted as white was a question some decades or centuries ago. You know, Germans count as white. Now Irish count as white. Now Italians count as white. The expansion of that has allowed whiteness to shift and adapt itself to changing demographics in the United States, but it hasn't dismantled an alleged white superiority or supremacy in that sense. It hasn't dismantled that structure. I mean, the end of chattel slavery didn't dismantle that. The end of Jim Crow and legalized segregation in the United States, that didn't change that. Changing demographics in the United States, where more migrations occurring of groups that at one point didn't count as white, that hasn't changed that structure yet either. What is whiteness is a very contextual and on-the-ground kind of question. When I'm thinking of when Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, an African-American philosopher one time, was being asked to define what was African-American. I mean, those questions, it's not just whiteness, but any kind of racial category. In what sense are these even real? You know, there's nothing biologically in us that divides us up into these racial groups. And one of Du Bois' answers was, you know, I know who's black when I look at who has to ride at the back of the train. And this is, of course, back in the days when we had the Jim Crow laws. It's like, you know, when we can look around at the world and find structures that group people and categorize people. Now, sometimes those are fuzzy lines between who's going to count where, and there's passing that can go on, you know, one group and passing as a member of another group. But we can see in practices how people get divided and categorized and then, in many cases, treated differently because of those categorizations.
Yeah, what do you think motivates white privilege?
I think religion motivates it. I think economics and greed motivates it. And then if I give a more psychological answer, I do come back to that sense of priority that I was mentioning earlier, this sense of the world having a kind of implicit structure built to it where some people count more, are more treated more as full persons in our society than other people. Now, we often don't say that out loud or explicitly because that, you know, that's supposedly everyone's equal or could be equal in the United States. Supposedly we don't have these hierarchies. We're supposed you know, but to point them out then can be, you know, sort of like letting the cat out of the bag and saying, look, no, this sense of there being full persons and other people are not full persons, and this has long been part of the United States, but and race has been part of that. So I think some of it is the psychological sense of my world as a white person feels normal if I'm part of the group that's treated well, and there's something unjust or wrong in the world if I'm not. These habits of expectation, and the fragility then is the flip side of that, a fragility or inability to sort of really deal with a world that says, no, maybe you don't have that priority. Maybe you shouldn't have those advantages.
Is privilege more of a mindset and an agreement to operate under in a certain way in the world that embraces almost a denial of other people's suffering? What gives you entree into this world? If you're Irish, suddenly now you're in. If you're Italian, now you're in. So the parameters are changing. What qualifies you to get into the in club?
So it is a mindset, although it's not, and I'm very interested in that side of it, but I want to add that it's not merely a mindset. So it's not just that I can realize I have white privilege and think I want to live in and experience my world in a different way, and therefore I'm just going to get rid of my white privilege. What would it look like to actually try and not have white privilege in this situation? I get pulled over for speeding. The white cop, I realize, is letting me off and giving me a warning instead of a ticket. Now, how would I interrupt that privilege? Would I have said, no, officer, really, you need to give me the ticket. Don't let me off the hook because I'm white. Or, you know, I guess I could have run over to his car and said, you really shouldn't have done that. Or maybe I should say, please make sure if you stop a black person, you let them off the hook too and give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, what does this scenario look like of how I could refuse white privilege? I think it's not as easy as it looks. And so there are going to be some different ways of trying to use white privilege against itself. But also, why would you want to try and get out of that club? Why would a white person want to get out of the club if it's giving them advantages? And I think there are answers to that question, but no one slows down to talk about that. We throw around flowery words like, well, I want to be a good person. I don't want to do bad things. Or I care about justice. I don't want things to be unfair. But those things haven't motivated white people historically to do much any different. So what's really, really going to motivate someone to want to change that situation so there isn't a club of whiteness to get into? I think ultimately that's what it's going to take, not expanding the club or to include a few people of color or something. We've got to talk about getting rid of that club, so to speak. But how to do that, it's going to be existentially and emotionally and socially and perhaps economically, financially, it's going to be a big challenge for white people. So I don't paint a real easy or pretty picture of what this would look like, except that I do try and get white people at the end to really ask themselves that hard question. Why would this matter to you? And you need to be able to answer that question. It's because this is going to be a long haul with a lot of work. And if you're going to be in there for the long haul and not just be fragile, the phrase I used from one of my favorite philosophers, Linda Martine Alcoff, she talks about why people have got to have skin in the game and realize that they do have skin in the game, that this matters to the quality of their life too. But that involves that familiar world becoming strange and that I don't mean to throw around big words, you know, but that existential, I got to use that word, that kind of existential shaking of one's world is going to be part of what's involved.
Yeah, and it does seem that there also needs equally to be a discussion around breaking down the idea of privilege. I mean, reframing it. Just as people reframe adversity into strength, reframe privilege into disadvantage, can it be also reframed? Is that also part of what needs to happen?
Yes, yes. I think that's really, really captures it well. It's not because you're just trying to do good to others in some kind of charity situation. That's if that's really all white people could do, they should just sort of step aside and get out of the way, because that's only making the situation worse. I think guilt sometimes on the part of white people gets used as a way to kind of sidestep other forms of action. The more a person feels shamed, I think the less that they're likely to try and make some kind of positive change in their life. I think that turns into just toxic resentment that gets spewed back in some very violent ways, sometimes self-violence, and sometimes violence toward others. I think there's a lot of class dumping that goes on here. I think it's middle to upper class white people who might invoke shame, and a lot of poor white people looking back saying, I don't see this privilege. I don't feel this shame. Why are you telling me I'm a bad person because of that? And so it's going to feel risky, but we're going to have to have some conversations there about that and not just dumping shame on other people. What does it mean to realize that the quality of one's own life as a white person is tied up with that question of the quality of other people's lives and how injustices it harms the lives of all of us? It really takes a kind of a shift in the zeitgeist or in one's worldview to sort of realize that my life and my world is really being harmed by this. Even if financially I'm getting benefits sometimes, even if the cops let me off the hook when I didn't get that ticket, there are these other ways that I'm harmed. And so if I'm going to try and fight against that club, I'm not just doing it for other people, and I'm doing it for me, and I've got white kids. I'm doing it for my kids, my family. I don't want to live in that kind of world either.
Do you think we're moving in a direction where we may not be able to afford this white privilege mindset anymore, that the world will even tolerate it in terms of our own survival as a human species?
I certainly hope we can't, but it is hard to know how to figure out how to make a meaningful change that's really going to tackle that entire structure.
So how do we do it? What do you propose?
How does this huge, big structural thing of a kind of global white supremacy and priority, how does that get changed? I don't know. I do know, though, that here I am living my life. I get up every morning, get out of bed, and I got to make decisions about what I'm doing. And I impact the lives of some small set of people that I interact with at work and at school and my family and et cetera. Am I spreading toxic whiteness in those interactions? Are there ways that I can try and change that or eliminate that? And those are things maybe that I can make a difference. And you're supposed to be the one with the power, in charge, and all the privilege. There's something that's quite nasty that happens to a person in that situation. There's a viciousness there. There's an inability to even see the suffering that other people might be engaged in. And I think that's one of the habits of whiteness. There are all kinds of ways we structure our world so that white people, it's not that they're looking away, just that the world is set up so that it doesn't even exist. We need to know how to use our past. But if we think of our past as something we've got to figure out what to do with, maybe that is a way of talking about a kind of agency or a choice, but that's not free-floating, free of any kind of past that we've had.
I would think on both sides of the equation, for the privileged as well as, again, the underprivileged.
Yes. If white people can't start taking up those questions and figuring them out for themselves too, then that, you know, then we're in some deep trouble. We're really behind and need to catch up on some of that historical work and how we're going to use our past. What am I going to do with that? How can I transform it, do something with it that's different maybe than what's been done with it before? But that recreation is exactly what white people have got to start figuring out.
Thank you so much, Shannon Sullivan, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And you've been listening to author and philosopher Shannon Sullivan speaking about her new book, White Privilege, due out in the fall, as well as her current book, Good White People.